Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. Today, I'm happy to present another extended interview, and my guest is Linda McQuaig. Linda is a National Newspaper Award-winning journalist and commentator who has worked for the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, and many other outlets. She is also a best-selling author of numerous books that have focused on and popularized a host of economic issues. Her most recent book, co-written with Neil Brooks, is The Trouble with Billionaires, How the Super Rich Hijacked the World, and How We Can Take It Back. Just last week, Linda wrote a sharp piece on the upcoming Ontario election. There, the provincial Conservative candidate for Premier, Tim Hudak, has been campaigning on a promise to create 1 million jobs over 8 years, using tax breaks and actual job cuts in the public sector to get there. It is with this far-flung promise of 1 million jobs that I started our conversation. So, Linda, I was hoping to make this perhaps a bit of a two-part conversation. I want to start with some questions about a recent piece you wrote on Tim Hudak's million jobs plan, and then eventually turn to a bigger picture, rising inequality, wrong-headed policy, and all these things that you've written about. But before getting to that, maybe we can begin with one word, imaginary. So this is how you describe Tim Hudak's job numbers, and maybe you could explain a bit what exactly you mean by this.
Okay, sure. Well, nice to talk to you. And sure, let's just plunge in with Tim Hudak and the imaginary jobs. I don't know how familiar your readers or your listeners are about the Hudak plan, but, you know, he's, claiming that, you know, he's going to create 1 million jobs if he becomes Premier of Ontario after the next election. And in my column that you referenced, I point out that, the one thing he doesn't mention is that these jobs are essentially imaginary. In the sense that, well, they are kind of imaginary because he might as well have just picked that number out of a hat, frankly. He does give a breakdown of how what the numbers will be, what policies will lead to what number of jobs created. But they're based on a fundamental flaw. Like, basically, what he did was he had the Conference Board of Canada do some estimates for him. And, you know, they projected, the essence of his plan is, most important thing is cutting corporate taxes. And he's assuming that that's going to generate a certain amount of jobs. Now, I'll quickly just say what the Conference Board had to say about that, and then there's other critics of that whole idea. But the Conference Board did these estimates. If you cut corporate taxes, you can create such and such numbers of jobs. But they specifically put in the caveat that that's only true if you don't compensate for the lost revenue from the tax cuts by cutting other government spending. Because if you do that, then you'll lose jobs. So what Hudak did that was completely disingenuous and quite dishonest, really, was he just took their numbers and left out the caveat. And yet, in fact, he's doing exactly, his plan includes exactly what the Conference Board said would, you know, create a problem, essentially. He's cutting 100,000 public sector jobs. That's what he's pledged to do. And that's how he's going to pay for his corporate tax cuts that will create these other jobs. But he's not taking into account the fact that the Conference Board and any other economist will tell you that if you then cut government spending, you know, by eliminating 100,000 people from the public sector payroll, that has enormous consequences, not just for them, but for the entire economy.
Right. And that's exactly what I was going to ask you about as well, right? You know, you contrast these imaginary jobs that are going to be created with these very real jobs that are on the chopping block.
That's right. So you have the imaginary jobs, and then you have the real jobs. The real jobs are the ones that are going to be eliminated. Those are real jobs, you know, held by real workers that provide real services to real people. Like, they're jobs in you know, public health care, you know, education, social services, the things people need. So by eliminating them, not only do you lose those services, but you're putting 100,000 Ontario residents out of work. That has enormous consequences. Those are people that, apart from the suffering that creates for them, you know, will have no money to spend. They won't have the money to pay taxes. I mean, we know this. Any economic model will show that when you lay people off, it has an effect that's felt throughout the economy. So by just ignoring that, you know, ignores what the conference board said. And in fact, I phoned I got through to the deputy chief economist at the conference board. And for one thing, he pointed out that, you know, I asked him, did he endorse the million jobs plan of the conservatives? And he said, no, not at all. And neither had they even seen it. And, you know, he went on to point out that they had just done this one little piece of analysis and that they had the caveat that I mentioned. And I asked, well, did you know about the 100,000? Did you factor the 100,000 jobs that HUDAC's planning to eliminate public sector jobs? Did you factor that into your calculation? He said, no, we didn't look into that at all. So the whole thing is completely, completely misleading, if not downright dishonest, I think, on the part of the Conservatives.
Yeah, and I think you make a very interesting point. In addition to that, that actually one of the most stunning aspects of this plan is that it is actually being taken very seriously, though. You know, it's filled with very precise figures, as you point out. You know, not even, you know, 120,000 jobs, but 118,000, you know, .0. You know, and these are giving it this sort of aura of rigor. And what does this say about you know, our media or popular imagination that we are ready to take this kind of stuff very seriously?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's not as if the media has just, you know, accepted it whole or anything. There has been skepticism expressed. You know, the media commentators will sort of express some skepticism about the possibility of creating all these jobs. But at the same time, they kind of accepted as bold and, you know, a strong statement by HUDAC. And they don't seem to sort of, you know, I mean, there, of course, are exceptions. But by and large, HUDAC is getting away with sort of presenting this as a bold strategy. And I think, you know, there's been some criticism in the media, but basically not too much examination of those numbers and how truly bogus they really are.
And what's some of the economic thinking that
Think? Well, okay, first of all, yeah, one of the points I wanted to make was that this whole notion, like the key thing in the HUDAC plan is this old familiar line that we hear from business economists and business people all the time, or certain business people all the time, that sort of cut corporate taxes and that will create confidence in business people, and that confidence will lead them to invest and create jobs. That's the theory, right? But there's no evidence that theory works. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, the brilliant U.S. economist, he has a lovely description for this. He says that theory is based on the confidence fairy. You know, I mean, there's just no evidence it works, and we can see that in Canada actually, because we've cut corporate taxes in Canada dramatically. Since 2000, we've cut our corporate tax rate in half, essentially. And so you would think, you know, wow, cut our corporate tax rate in half. If this theory works about, you know, that creating business confidence, leading them to invest, we should have just a surplus of jobs, right, given the enormous tax cutting we've done. And yet we don't. We don't. We continue to suffer from an overly high unemployment rate. And what's happened is business has taken those savings and they've held on to them. They haven't invested them. And we know this because Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of Canada, pointed to this, I guess it was about a year or so ago, when he talked about how business in Canada, corporations are sitting on something like $520 billion of what he called dead money, That is money that they've accumulated, and a lot of that is from the corporate tax cutting, and you know, have failed to invest. And Carney was kind of admonishing them, come on, do some investment. But they have no interest in investing because, you know, because demand is so depressed because there's still, you know, too high unemployment and too little compensation for most workers. So and by the way, that $520 billion has recently, you know, just keeps rising.
I think it's even over 600.
Yeah, I
now,
think it's.
Yeah.
I think the last time I saw was $626 billion in just this money that corporations are sitting on, failing to invest. So the idea of doing more corporate taxes at this point to create jobs is just a ludicrous proposition.
And maybe I can get you to say a bit more. Maybe now is a good time to zoom out of this election campaign in Ontario, and think a bit more broadly. So, I mean, you've been writing about economic policy, debt and deficit reduction, tax cut deregulation, all this stuff since your first book in the late 80s, I believe. And so maybe you could speak a bit, you know, in that sort of in this longer context, what how does the present campaign in Ontario fit in? But what's this sort of broader economic narrative that's sort of gathered steam over these decades that you've been writing?
The broad economic narrative is that, you know, basically starting in the early 80s and continuing until now, we've had this dramatic transfer of income and wealth from ordinary people to those at the top. I mean, it's just very, very dramatic. You know, and maybe just to back up a bit, to put that in a broader context, what we saw in the period before that, like the early post-war period, right from the end of the Second World War till about 1980, that was a period of very strong economic growth and much more equality in terms of income distribution. You know, people often sort of say, oh, the rich always get richer, da-da-da-da-da. In fact, in that early post-war period, the rich were not getting richer. They were actually, the income gains were being much more widely distributed. So, in fact, the middle and lower income, their incomes were growing at a higher, at a faster pace than the incomes of the people at the top. That's really quite striking. And the people at the top ended up with a smaller share of the national wealth, national income, than they had in the period before that. But what's happened since 1980 is that essentially, I think what happened was the powerful interests, the corporations and the wealthy people, effectively fought back against this growing equality in the early post-war years and pushed for all kinds of changes to our economic policies. And it's that package sometimes called Thatcherism or Reaganism. You know, we all know it is tax cuts for the rich, social spending cuts, privatization, deregulation, a tax on labor. It's a very specific package, something that's called neoliberalism. And that's basically been put in place in Canada, the U.S., and Britain over the past 30, 35 years. And the result of it is this dramatic increase in inequality, with virtually all the gains in recent year, all the income gains going to those at the top.
I think an interesting thing you say, too, is that, you know, we actually have had this narrative of growing inequality. And at least in the U.S.,
yeah,
this has become quite a focus. But you've written that Canada so far has sort of been missing from this debate. You know, many people think that Canada doesn't have to deal with this sort of U.S.-style inequality. And to some extent, that's true. But you've said that it's not quite right, and that we're not really trailing our neighbors by so much. Can you explain maybe a bit about...
Yeah, no. I mean, it's quite interesting. It's absolutely true that the U.S. is the most extreme in terms of income inequality. I mean, they're top 1% and top 0.01%, you know, have just made out like bandits. I mean, they are the accumulation of money at the top in the U.S. is obscene, frankly. You know, the growing billionaire class. And meanwhile, the people at the middle and lower ends, you know, have just not made any gains. It is the most extreme. But what is fascinating is that Canada is following closely behind the U.S. in going in that direction. We are not as extreme. We do not have a top-heavy situation as the U.S., but we're following closely behind. In fact, there's a recent OECD study, it just came out this month, that showed, measured sort of the share of income gain going to the top 1%, and did this across countries, and found that, in fact, the United States was the most extreme, and Canada was the second most extreme. So this notion that sort of income inequality, and I've heard this from the people in the Harper government, I've heard the statements that they've made sort of suggesting, oh, that's an American problem, we don't have that here. Well, we do have that here. We very much have that here. Our billionaires may not be quite as colorful and flamboyant as some of the outspoken and outrageous billionaires that we see in the U.S., but they're extremely wealthy and extremely powerful. And I think they are calling the shots in many ways here in Canada, in ways that I don't think we're sufficiently paying attention to. That's one of the, of course, the consequences of extreme inequality, that economic power translates into political power. So if you allow resources to be captured so heavily by those at the top, they are going to be the ones that influence the political game as well.
And I think this actually, and then this ends up having sort of very real life effects. I think you've also cataloged a bit, concrete effects on health, education, other areas of our lives that are, directly resulting from this rise in inequality. Maybe you could point to some of these.
There's just such excellent work that's been done on the huge consequences of inequality. I mean, one book I think a lot of people are familiar with is The Spirit Level, that looks at income inequality across many different nations. Lots of other research too. But what this research finds overwhelmingly is just really significant impacts of extreme inequality, in terms of things like depriving young people of opportunities for upward mobility. I mean, just kills that. Not to mention financial insecurity, debt for so many people, stifling the economic potential of a country, destroying social cohesion. All kinds of negative impacts on people's health and well-being. I mean, there's just massive evidence that extreme inequality is bad for society. And then, of course, the one that I mentioned that I think gets far too little attention, and that is the impact on democracy. When you get so much power concentrated in a few hands, that has enormous impact on the political system because we have a democracy, but what happens is the powerful corporations, first of all, they can always sort of threaten or implicitly threaten to withdraw their capital if they don't get their way politically, if we don't put in place the kind of economic policies they want, and that intimidates people. Ordinary voters may think it would be much nicer to have strong social programs. In fact, we know that they think that. But they're afraid often to vote that way because they're afraid, business will punish us by pulling out. That's an enormous power that business has. And so whenever you tilt things disproportionately more in favor of business, you increase that sense of power. And I think we see that. If you look at something like, climate change, I mean, there's a horrendously important problem facing humankind. And yet, what are we doing on it? Well, corporations, the fossil fuel industry is absolutely hell-bent on you know, developing all the oil that they can. And you know, regardless of the impacts on climate change. And so, you know, they are essentially calling the shots. And if you look at Canadian policy, I mean, the Harper government is just full steam ahead with the tar sands development, even though the consequences of that are horrific in terms of climate change. And I think that reflects the growing power of the business elite and the fossil fuel companies in particular.
Linda McQuaig, it was a pleasure to speak with you.
Okay, really nice to speak with you, Michal.
Thanks so much. That was Linda McQuaig, author, journalist, economics muckraker. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Until then.